Sports USA presents Classic Conversations with Joe Morgan, featuring some of Joe's greatest interviews with entertainment icons, Hall of Famers, and champions. Now, Classic Conversations with Joe Morgan on Sports USA.
And welcome back to the Joe Morgan Show. I have the distinct privilege of talking to my good friend, Mr. Ahmad Rashad. Ahmad, it's interesting because if I say Ahmad Rashad, most of my listeners are going to say, well, sportscaster, you know, Emmy Award winning broadcaster, et cetera, et cetera. They forget that you were a great football player.
You know, Joe, that is something that when I played sports, I strive to be the very best I could possibly be, and I was very proud of the fact of, you know, of whatever I left out there and whatever the legend was at the end of my career. I felt very good about that. When I started working in television, my goal was to make people forget about me as a football player and think of me as a sportscaster. Now, that's a double-edged sword because at some point, if you can do that, that means you've become very successful at your next career, extremely successful, but... Yeah. There are times that you sit back and go, hey, wait a minute. I played. I tell you what, one little story. Yeah. You know, my daughter was about in the sixth grade or something, and she came home one day and she says, you know, there's a little boy in my class that wants your autograph. He says you played for the Vikings. Did you? my daughter asked me that. I said, did I? At that point, I realized I might have overdone it on the other side.
No, I agree, and I think there has to be, you know, a perfect mix here. You're an All-American running back, not just a player. You're an All-American running back in Oregon. You played with Dan Fouts, who's, you know, in the Football Hall of Fame. You're inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame. You're the number four pick, you know, by the St. Louis Cardinals. I mean, that's a pretty good resume. You played in the Super Bowl.
I have four Pro Bowls, Pro Bowl MVP, All-Pro, and everybody forgot.
I agree. See, it happens to me a little bit. A lot of times when I was broadcasting, people would forget that I played. It was like, you know, I see a second baseman make a play, and I say, man, that was a good play. And it's as if I never knew what a good play was at second base, you know?
Right.
So it's kind of interesting there. And I've always felt that even with John Madden, when I talked to John a few weeks ago, the fact that people forgot that he was a great coach because he was, his second career was so good. I mean, it's great to have a second career and a good place to go. But as you said, I guarantee you, you put more into that first career to get to be where you are than you did the second because you started that first career when you were a little kid.
Absolutely. There was so much put into that. And but you know what? It's one of those things. Life, I think, even as a kid, I always looked up to players like yourself, like Bill Russell, like Will Chamberlain, like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, players that had an opinion and that could speak the English language. I think when I was younger, every athlete that I'd see on television, African-American, either he was a great athlete, but they'd put him on an interview and I'd be almost embarrassed by the way he spoke.
Right.
And
correct.
I took it on myself that I was going to change that. You know, it wasn't when I was going to be a broadcaster. I was going to make sure that, you know, that everybody accepted me for my merits as a complete human being. And you realize that sports, it's only 2 hours in the day when you grow up, and there's 22 more hours. I mean, some you got to sleep, but there's all day to be knowledgeable or learn things or be curious about everything. So I made a point of making sure that my the onus on my life was not just sport, ever.
That's a great point, you know, especially for young people to realize, you know, your baseball career, your football career, your basketball career is short-lived. I mean, it's going to be a short time in your life, and the rest of your life you have to, you know, find something to do. And obviously you have found something to do. I was wondering myself, though, I mean, you covered the NFL when you left, you know, football. You've been in the NBA, you covered the NBA, the Olympics, everything. No baseball. I know
did,
you must have played.
I did play baseball, but I had my eyesight wasn't good. You know, I could run and catch, but my eyesight, I just couldn't see. You know, baseball, you got to be able to pick that ball up immediately. And I was always, because I was such a good athlete, I wouldn't pick it up immediately, but I could overcome that. It got to a point where overcoming that became too hard. Not too hard, but it's just that, you know, it wasn't instinctive. You know, it wasn't instinctive. I remember once I did a story on baseball, and I went down and went to training camp with the St. Louis Cardinals. And Whitey Herzog said, you know what I do with you? I turn you around and have you bat left-handed, and I don't care if you just touch the ball, I know you're going to be safe because I can run.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, but I'd be a liability in that outfield. If they ever hit one to me, you talking about doing a disco before I caught it, I'd run up, it'd be behind me.
You talk about seeing the baseball. It's interesting. John Thompson and I, we have this argument every time I see him because he heard me say on TV once that you see the stitching on the ball and watch the rotation, and that tells you where the ball is going to end up. You know, if it's spinning for a curveball, mm-hmm. you know, rotation. And John swears you can't see the stitching on the baseball.
That's why he played basketball.
Exactly. But even that, I said, John, can you see the rotation on the basketball when you shot it? He said, yes. I said, well, baseball's the same way. We had to train ourselves to do that, you know. You've covered the Olympics. What is that like?
It is the greatest sporting spectacle in the world. It is a time where you see the entire world come together for 2 weeks, and the sportsmanship, the camaraderie, the feeling of oneness, the feeling of seeing countries cheer for their home team, and then all of a sudden finding a pet team from some other country, to see athletes from places you never heard of making it to the Olympics and competing on that top level and completing just for the joy of sport. I know it's changed a little bit now because they pay these guys, but still, it's, you know, they're not making tons of money like professional athletes, but they still do it for the joy of the sport. And there's so many wonderful stories that are involved in the Olympics. And it becomes more than a sport because you find a vested interest in a lot of sports that you never heard of, but because you heard the story about some kid that grew up as a, you know, his father was a sheep herder and his grandfather was a sheep herder, and somewhere he found a heavy rock and he started throwing the rock, and all of a sudden that rock turned into a shot put, and all of a sudden that kid was the best shot putter in the world. Those kinds of stories, I think they're so inspirational for people that, you know, everything's possible. You know, everything is possible. So I think that the Olympics, by far, is one of the greatest events, you know, in sports.
And it's interesting you say that because you've covered so many different big events and things like that. You covered the Dream Team. You've covered the NBA. Talk a little bit about the Dream Team and all those personalities.
Well, the Dream Team, here's a bunch. You know, 12 of the best basketball players in the world and sent them to the Olympics. They were also overwhelmed with the Olympics. They were overwhelmed. They set the world on fire in terms of basketball. Right. And it's from that Dream Team that we now have all these players in the NBA. We have all these countries that, you know, people that knew nothing about basketball, or it wasn't the number one sport in their country, or it wasn't even something that they consider. You know, they consider playing soccer. But because of the Dream Team of Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan and Larry Bird and Charles Barkley and that whole group, they were the Beatles. It was one of the most incredible things ever. When they had their training camp down in San Diego, and they would have some of the best pickup games that you had ever seen, with these guys, with their egos and their ability going at each other every single day, every single day. And it was just great to be a fly on the wall and watch all of that. But when you saw them introduced to the world, it was just incredible. It was, those guys couldn't go anywhere in Barcelona. They were just followed everywhere. I remember one night Michael and I went out to dinner, and we had probably 30, 40 cars following us, so we had to lose the cars before we found a place to go to dinner. But it was just, it's hard to explain that. When I see some of these teams, you know, the big three in Miami, and they thought that they had a big thing going, but there was nothing close to what the Dream Team was. It was truly a dream team, and there was never anything else like that.
And I'm speaking with Ahmad Rashad, a great friend and a great sportscaster. One of the things that fans do not understand, they think just because you're good, you shouldn't have to depend on luck. But as we know, football, you have the points on the ball. It bounces differently sometimes. The baseball, it hit a rock or hit a base, it bounces differently. And people just accept, well, we got all these great players, we're supposed to win. You made a great point there. You have to have a little bit of luck. And talk about that with your Super Bowl teams the team you played on.
Well, as you were saying, you know, here's another team that puts together so much talent every year and expects to win is the Yankees.
Right.
But I have always found that the better you are, the luckier you are.
That's true.
I mean, the guys that aren't any good aren't lucky at all. Right. They're never lucky. Right. It's just the guys that are really, really good, they're always lucky. The Super Bowl, you know, as I look back at that Super Bowl, first of all, it was a great thing to be able to play in a Super Bowl, but it wasn't the, you know, it wasn't the wherewithal with all that kind of thing. It wasn't the, you know, the greatest thing ever. And even if we won that Super Bowl, I still don't feel like it would have been the crowning moment of my athletic career. It was just another right. game, and it was a big game, and it was a very important game, but they have them every year. And the fact of getting there is a great accomplishment on its own.
Yes.
We played the Oakland Raiders. The Vikings had gone to 3 Super Bowls before I got there, and they had lost 3. And I believe that there was so much pressure on this 4th one that we changed our plays, we changed what we, you know, what we had done to get to where we were, and I don't think that we were as well prepared. The Raiders came out and did exactly what they do. They throw bombs, you know, they you know, Ken Stabler does what they never changed anything. And we changed everything. It, you know, there were a couple times that I remember Tarkenton calling a play, and as we broke the huddle, you know, Sammy White would say, "Hey, what was that play?" It's like, man, we're in trouble. We're in trouble. We, you know, you got to go with what got you there. And somehow, you know, it just wasn't the day. You know, it wasn't. And the thing is, here's the weird thing about sports. As when I first got to the Vikings, we won, I think it was 14 games during that time. We went 12-2. So I figured we'd lose the Super Bowl, no problem. We'll win it next year.
Right.
Or the year after. Never got back.
Now, that's the biggest thing that we as athletes had to overcome. Wait till next year. You know, whoever coined that phrase didn't know anything about it. They weren't players, you know.
Right.
It was somebody, you know, writing a story. Said, wait till next year. But you don't get back. I got to my first World Series with Cincinnati in 72, and we felt the same way. Hey, man, we're a great team. We'll get back next year. Guess what? It took me 3 more years before I got back there again. Not only, you know, to win one, but it took me 3 years just to get back. And people wonder, all right, you play in the World Series, you play on the Super Bowl, and then the next year you play and you don't get back. What does that do to your personality? The next year, what does it do to you when you continue not, you know, to get back? And especially for you, since you never got back there again. But I understand what you're saying there about it wasn't like the world was going to end if we won, or the world was going to end if we lost. You know, it was just one game, and it was a great game. And that's what I think a lot of players have to accept and play it that way, rather than say, I'm putting all my eggs in this one basket. If I'm not successful, the egg cracks, I'm finished.
Yeah, you have a lot of guys that have a tough time adjusting to life if it's that
right.
way. It is, life is about preparing as well as you can,
yes,
playing as hard as you can, and go have dinner.
Thank you.
that's I learned that from Bud Grant, reiterated, I mean, it's pretty much the way I felt, but he sort of reiterated when I was playing for the Minnesota Vikings, is that's the way it is. You just, you know, you prepare, you play as hard as you can, and then that's it. That's it. You know, if you don't win, I think it's really disappointing, especially when you get there the first time, then you're so hungry to get there again if you don't win.
Yes.
You're so hungry. So now there's an aching to try to get there again. And it's just, you know, we never got there again. I think of guys like Dan Marino. He got there his first rookie year in the league and never went again.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because with me, I felt the same way. When the game was over, I'd sit in my locker. I wrote in a little book about the game, what happened. And when I left there, I never took it home with me where I was, you know, mad at my family or yelled at my wife because I went 0-for-4 and struck out 2 or 3 times. You know, I never did that because, like you said, you had to walk away from it because there's two different people. First of all, you're the athlete, and then you go home and you're the father or the husband. So you have to be able to separate those. And I'm like you. I find that sometimes guys can't separate them.
The times that you find guys that aren't able to separate it, I think those are the guys that have a tough time making an adjustment in their life.
Yeah.
You can't separate yourself from the job that you do. Then when that job's over, who are you?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm speaking with Ahmad Rashad, who's most known as a TV personality. Let's talk about your TV exploits a little bit here. I mean, you've hosted so many shows. I mean, reality show, reality TV, the NBA, you know, inside the NBA with Ahmad Rashad, which I thought was a great show. I mean, most of the things you've done, I've really enjoyed and followed you. Talk about them, and which one was your favorite?
The thing I liked about television, or I do like about television, it is I always felt that if people at home knew anything about the players that they were watching, they would have a more vested interest in watching that player.
Kind of like the Olympics.
Yeah, kind of like the Olympics, but even in basketball, play, you have all these stars that you see, but you don't really know. You've never seen them do normal things. You never see them be normal. You've only seen them being interviewed after a game or, you know, when they've got their game face on or they're talking in sound bites. My whole goal was to go to this guy's house and show you what he was really like as a normal guy, just in case, like, for instance, if he lived down the corner from you. That's the kind of interview I was going to go do. I was going to show you, you know, who goes to the store, does he go to the store, you know, who takes his little boy to school, things that would endear you, that you would see that here's a guy that's one of the greatest athletes in the world, but he does the same things that we all do every day.
Right.
You know, and that was just, you know, it was sort of a concept that was almost not really done when I first started doing inside stuff, and the show just took off. And guys would, you know, I'd go to a basketball game, and guys would come by my seat saying, hey, when am I going to be on the show? You know, so it was one of those things, and we always had fun. There was always laughs, because you and I both agree on this, that being a professional athlete has got to be the best job in the world.
Yes.
There's nothing more that I can even imagine that you have so much fun. The pressures aren't, you know, anywhere. People talk about all that crazy pressure. It's like, you know what, my father had pressure. He was trying to feed seven kids. You know, making about $50 a week. That was real pressure.
Right.
You know.
No, you're 100% right. I think I've always said when I even started broadcasting, I said this is the second best job in the world for me. I said the best job is playing, and nothing comes close.
Right.
I enjoy, you know, broadcasting baseball games, enjoyed it, but there's nothing like playing and the adrenaline you get, rush you get from, you know, the first pitch or the opening kickoff, you know, all
right.
those kind of things that were always special to me.
That's exactly right. It was just, and then, as you say, you know, once we both got into broadcasting, it's like, you know what, this is a way to stay involved in the game
right.
without really caring about the outcome.
Correct.
You know, so I don't have any. I have no pressure now. It's like, you know, whoever wins, they win. The best team wins, and that's kind of it. It's not like, you know, I realize that, you know, hey, you know, this game this week is going to come down to if I play well, we win. If I don't play well, we don't win. I knew that right. going throughout my whole career. Now, I'm not even playing, and it doesn't matter who wins. I can just sit back and enjoy, you know, the professionalism, the athleticism of these guys out here doing it at the top level.
And being honest with you, Ahmad, that was the first thing I had to accept because, you know, when I walked on the field every day, it was almost life and death. I went out there to win, you know.
Right.
And then when you retire, I was still thinking that way a little bit, you know, that everybody else should take it that way. But then you find that a lot of the players, and especially players today, you know, I had this conversation with Charles Barkley, the players today are a little different. You know, and I always said this about baseball, the game doesn't change, but the people who play the game changes.
Yeah.
And that's what I view.
There's a lot to be said about the way media is today.
You
know, everything is quick and now and instant gratification, and it's not at the risk of sounding like an old person.
Well, we are.
Yeah, we are. You know, I am an old person, but the game was totally different before. It was about winning.
Right.
It wasn't about making a highlight show. It wasn't
Correct.
About dancing when your team is behind by 12 points. You know, it wasn't about jumping up from a tackle and doing some little dance, you know, when your guys are getting beat. The professionalism has changed a little bit. You know, it was about winning. It wasn't about being the player of the week. The
right.
player of the week, they have plays of the week, and the guys got beat 30-0. You know, or baseball, they got beat 5-0, but here's a guy that made some great catch. It didn't help.
Right.
So it should be some kind of thing that, you know, there are no plays of the week unless you win.
Right.
Because all the spoils go to the winner. The loser doesn't get anything but a zero.
When I talk to you, I talk to Bill Russell, a basketball star. I talk to all these players. That seems to be the difference. It's about, you know, we always talk about winning. We talk about doing this. And maybe it is because we are older and, you know, we had a different, you know, philosophy at that time. I think one of the things that happens is that, like you say, the highlight shows show guys, you know, hit a home run even when they lose 10-1, you know,
mm-hmm.
or something like that. And I think that interferes a little bit with the personality of the players. You know, I work with the Reds, and sometimes I hear stuff, that kind of bothers me in that you're worried about the play or you're worried about the one hit you got rather than, you know, whether we win or lose.
Right. It certainly is disconcerting to see that. I realize that, you know, the world could be going in that direction, but I will forever be bottom line wins guy. You know,
well, I think that's the best way to be.
Yeah, it's about winning. It's not about, you know, winning makes stars.
Yes.
You know, stars don't make winning. Winning makes stars. I'm still an executive producer at the NBA, and I do specials. I do six specials a year, one at the beginning of the season, one at Christmas, one at the All-Star game, one at the beginning of the playoffs, and then two during the playoffs. So I still keep my hands involved, and they're the same sort of, you know, player interactive sort of shows that we do. We have a lot of fun. We go to guys' houses and get a chance to sit down and talk to them. And it's funny that, you know, a lot of these kids that I'm interviewing now grew up watching Inside Stuff. So it's almost to them like if I show up, they've made it. Like Derrick Rose told me one time, he goes, you know what, my whole life, one of the things I wanted to do, I wanted to be a professional basketball player, and I wanted you to interview me because that would mean I'd made it. I took that as a compliment.
Well, you should. I mean, and it tells a little bit about you, you know, the fact that the players trust you and the players wanted to be around you, you know, for so long, and it was unwarranted criticism of you because you had a relationship with Michael Jordan. Anyone else, that would have been a great thing. But they wanted to make it like it was a bad thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was a relationship that people would die for. And this relationship that we had nothing to do with basketball.
Correct.
You know, we were friends. Our families were friends. We just both happened to work. You know, he was a basketball player, and I happened to be, you know, an announcer at that time, and had the greatest contact in the world.
Right.
You know, we talk every night about everything, anything, the whole league, whatever it is. You know, just kind of kicking it back and forth. So it was one of those things that during his heyday, you know, I was always there, and I took a lot of heat from, I think, jealousy.
Jealous, that's exactly what I was going to say.
You know, they were so jealous that, you know, it's like, oh, I remember one time Michael was going to do an interview about his gambling problem in San Diego or something. So one day we're going to the game, and I'd always ride to the games with him. He goes, you know what? I want to talk about that today. Can you get a camera? I went, yeah, but you know what? I'm going to ask you whatever I need to ask you.
Right.
So he went, no. I want to talk about it, and I want to do it today. Will you tell me what time I'll be at the game? We'll do the interview. I go to Dick Ebersol, and I say, Dick, Michael wants to do this. But what I want you guys to do is I want you guys to write the questions.
Right.
I don't want to be Good responsible point. For any of these questions.
Yeah.
So they give me the questions. We sat down. I did the whole interview. We stopped. I said, did you get everything you need? Are there any more questions we need to ask? They went, no, great. Well, the next day, I got blistered.
Right.
Just blistered. Yeah. I mean, how can he do the interview? He's too close. You know, he didn't hammer him. He didn't do this. He didn't do that. And no one stood up for me, you know. But, you know, that's just the way it works, I guess.
Well, I remember that the time that you and I talked, and we didn't think NBC stood up for you.
They not
exactly.
at all. Because all they had to do was say, you know what, we let this guy do the interview, and we came together as a group, and we figured out the questions. He didn't ask the questions on his own.
Exactly. And that bothered me because, like I said, I was there at the time, and I saw this happening. But the real point here is a lot of people couldn't get access to Michael like you could, and they were jealous of that. And that's one of the tough things, you know, about this business is that, you know, and you talked about you didn't hammer him. You know, that's the reason I do this show, Ahmad. I didn't want to do an interview kind of show because interviews often turn into interrogations.
Right.
I wanted to have conversations with people that I respect and have a chance for them to talk, you know, just about what they want to without me being, you know, the guy to ask him the tough questions, as they say. I just wanted to talk about sports, and that's why I do this show.
I never understood what the tough questions are.
Right.
I didn't even know what that means. A question's a question. I mean, if you're trying to ask a tough one, were you trying to be adversarial or are you trying
That's what it is.
You're trying to get the, is it about them turning the camera on you and having you ask it in such a way where you look like a tough guy or is it having a conversation? I remember there was one of the questions that Michael said, it was, does he have a gambling problem? So I said, do you think you have a gambling problem? He goes, no, I enjoy gambling, but I don't have a gambling problem. So I got killed by going, whoa, what do you mean you don't have a gambling problem? You did this, that, and the other. Well, you know what? He could gamble for $100,000, which would mean nothing to him, and I could gamble for a dollar, and it's kind of the same.
That was exactly what Michael said. He said, look, guys spend money on their own things. I spend them on here. He said, but it never affected my family. I never took money, you know, that was necessary, you know, for my family to bet on. And it's amazing to me that that was not acceptable. You know, no one wanted to accept that he didn't have a gambling problem. They wanted to make it a gambling problem because it would have made a big story.
I ended up talking to a guy that I think his name is Mitch Albom.
Yeah.
Out of Detroit, who took a shot at me and wrote a whole big article about, you know, I shouldn't have been the guy that did the interview. And so I called him on the phone. I said, so why shouldn't I have been the guy? Well, you're not a professional broadcaster or something. I said, I am pretty much as you are.
Right.
And he said, well, you're too close to it. Well, which is it? which one of them is it? And you know that ex-athletes, as much as when you're an athlete, that's a sort of a closed fraternity of professional athletes.
Yes.
It's something that you've done. Well, I find now that you have a lot of writers and other media people that sort of have a closed idea of that. They say athletes can't be that.
Right.
You know, because this guy goes, well, you don't have a degree in journalism.
Yeah.
Really?
Exactly. And most of them do not either.
No, they don't. And most of them want to be on TV now anyway.
Right.
You know, so they'd sell their soul to be on television anyway. So it was one of the things that I couldn't let me get. Like I say, the coolest thing about the whole thing was, you know what, when I grew up, I had a full life, and I still got a full life.
So right.
I didn't, you know, that wasn't anything I was going to make or break me. It was just something I did. I felt very good about it. I felt positive about it. I got great feedback from you, who I respect so much.
Yeah.
And from all the guys that would talk to me and say, hey, great interview. I'm good.
Right. Well, that's the point. The people we respect, as long as we have their you know, respect, we're okay. Ahmad, it's been great as usual. Thanks again for taking the time.
You're welcome, Joe.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Classic Conversations with Joe Morgan, featuring some of Joe's greatest interviews of all time. Get them all anytime at sportsusamedia.com, iTunes, the TuneIn app for your smartphone, iHeartRadio.com, and the iHeartRadio app for your smartphone. There, you can also check out some of SportsUSA's other great podcasts, like Snake Steaks with Jake Plummer, The Rich Report with Tom and Sam Rich, Ted Sobel's Excellent Sports Adventure, and The Fred Dreyer Show. This is Sports USA